Welcome to Out and About, a talk show here on WNHH about issues involving transgender people and LGBT people in general. My name is Melissa Lukes. I'm coming to you today from Fantasia Fair in Provincetown, Massachusetts. That's a transgender conference. It's now in its 42nd year, and it sure is a lot of fun. I've got a great guest with me. It's Professor Jennifer Finley Boylan. She's author of 15 books. She's the inaugural Anna Quinlan Writer-in-Residence at Barnard College of Columbia University. She also serves as the national co-chair of the Board of Directors of GLAAD. GLAAD is the media advocacy group accelerating acceptance for LGBTQ people, and that's worldwide. She's been a contributor to the op-ed page of the New York Times since 2007. In 2013, she became a contributing opinion writer for that page. Jenny also serves on the Board of Trustees of the Kinsey Institute Research on Sex, Gender, and Reproduction. She also serves as special advisor to the president of Colby College in Maine. She was a consultant and cast member for I Am Kate, the docuseries about Caitlyn Jenner that debuted on the E! Network in July 2015. And she also served as consultant to the Amazon series Transparent. Her new novel, Long Black Veil, is forthcoming from Penguin Random House in April 2017. Two other current projects are Falcon Quinn and Bullies of Green Blood, an anti-bullying YA project, and the anthology of older women experiences, The Bitch is Back. Her 2003 memoir, She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders, was the first best-selling work by a transgender American. A novelist and short story writer, she is also a nationally known advocate for civil rights. Jenny has appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show on four occasions, Live with Larry King twice, The Today Show, The Barbara Walters Special, NPR Marketplace and Talk of the Nation, and she has also been the subject of documentaries on CBS News 48 Hours and the History Channel. She lives in New York City and in Belgrade Lakes, Maine, with her wife, Dee Dee, and her two sons, Zach and Sean. Jenny, welcome to Out and About. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks for having me. I feel exhausted just listening to all that.
Well, I know. Well, there's a lot to know about you, that's for sure.
I should slow down, I think.
Right, maybe that's time for vacation. Anyway, I'd like to start out with, if it's okay with you, a little bit about your personal history. When did you discover you were trans, and how did you go about transitioning?
Great question. It's worth saying that there's no... I mean, obviously, I'll tell you my own story, but it's worth saying there's no single emblematic story of being trans or coming out as trans, and that whether you always knew, like I did, or whether you kind of come to an insight late in life, in your 70s or 80s, it's all cool. And, I'm a storyteller, and I spend a lot of time telling my own story because that's the one that I know. But I want to make sure that when people hear my story, it's not misconstrued as standing in for... I mean, there is no emblematic trans experience. There are so many different ways of being trans. There's so many different ways of coming to that identity. And that's, in some ways, that's more important than... That realization is more important than anything I have to say about my own journey. That said, I was one of the folks who kind of always knew... But it's also true that our understanding of what it means to be a boy or a girl changes over time, to be certain. And so I can tell you that I knew when I was, you know, 4 or 5, but what was it that I knew then? It's different from what I knew when I was 12, and it's different from what I knew when I was 40. If I look back, I knew that I definitely identified with girls even before I really understood the difference between boys and girls from a very early age. And in my own case, that really kind of had really nothing to do with clothes in particular or femininity. I've really never been an especially feminine person, but I think that's true of a lot of women.
It's true,
in fact.
Yeah.
I mention that because as I began to have a better understanding of exactly how much trouble I was in, which was adolescence, of course. I also felt a bit distanced from the communities of people that the few of them that there were in the media in the 60s and 70s, which is to say that at that time, the very few transgender people you'd see seemed to be, if they had been male-bodied, they certainly, because they seemed to come out of the drag world or the world of female impersonators, or and I certainly didn't especially identify with gay experience to the extent that I was never particularly attracted to men. So my, North Star was always women. It was a real puzzle. I think that being transgender to some degree means that from a very, very early age, you are given a kind of existential dilemma, and that you have to kind of try to solve issues at age 5 or 15 that many adults still find mind-boggling, right? And escapes them. It's why trans people, so many of them, I think, are very smart or philosophical or funny people. I see that as a unifying thing, because we've had to think from a very early age about these kind of profound issues of the mind and the body. Anyway, I knew I was trans from an early age. I tried denying it. I hoped that love, in fact, would cure me, that if I could get out of myself, that would make me content to stay a boy. Because I felt that coming out as trans and going through transition, what little I knew of it in those days, it seemed to me to invoke a life of marginality and danger, and I wasn't brave enough for those things. So, I looked, I hoped for love, I hoped for that kind of transformation, and all the while kind of battling the way one does, until at last I met my wife, Didi, in my late 20s. We married just after I turned 30, as is often the case with trans people, quickly found that love did not prevent me from being trans. It just meant that I had yet another secret now, including the secret of my identity, which I had kept from the person whom I most loved. So at long last, I began to come out to my wife in timid little stages in my 30s, and right around the time I turned 40, I began I went back into therapy to figure out what am I going to do with this, and so I finally went through transition, by which I mean living full time, hormones, and eventually the full medical transition. In my early 40s, so that was, 18 years ago now, which seems incredible to me. So I know that's a very long answer to a very simple question, but it's the thing about gender, isn't it? That all of the simple questions involve lengthy conversation.
It's never a short answer. That's right. Family. Well, you talked about your wife and everything, but other friends, coworkers, when you came out as trans, how did that work out?
So I'm an academic in a small town in New England, and that sounds like a recipe for an increased level of protection. I think it just sounds like that. So I came out about the year 2000, 2001, and largely I was... The people that I worked with rallied around me, largely. Even though I don't think they particularly understood it. The thing about coming out as trans, this is 15 years ago, it was like I'd invented the whole thing myself. There were just not a lot of trans people in the public eye. I felt like I had to win everybody over. I had to explain it. I had to kind of be a resource for people. I had to educate people as I went, and it was exhausting. Although in some ways, as a teacher by trade and as a writer by nature, I felt that I was well poised to do that work. But it was so on the one hand, things went pretty well. I mean, by this point in my life, I've met tens of thousands of transgender people, and the stories that we hear are mind-numbing and heartbreaking. You know, people who lose their jobs, who are fired, who lose their families and their children, and who wind up homeless. I mean, that's a not uncommon story. That was not my story, and I'm very aware of the fact that my experience is to some degree the result of privilege and 40 years of male socialization and all that. But having said all that, people at my college were generally supportive. People in my personal life were mostly supportive, but supportive doesn't necessarily mean easy. And the more intense and the more gendered the relationship, the more tears were shed.
Interesting.
So old friends, family members, my wife most particularly, siblings, parents, those folks had a different struggle than, the professor of economics down the hall.
Right, okay. Now, you've always been a professor of English, correct?
Yeah, well, not always. I mean, when I was very young, I had a lot of menial jobs. I worked in a bookstore. I mowed lawns. I made coffee. I worked in publishing. I was a reporter. So I went back to grad school just in my late 20s and kind of started over. But since my late 20s, I've been a writer, and a writer who found a home teaching in an English department in a little college in Maine called Colby, which is a great school, and I was there for 25 years until leaving just this spring to join the faculty, or two springs ago now, to join the faculty at Barnard in New York City.
How do you find living in New York City as a trans person?
Well, delightful in a number of ways. For one thing, it gets me out of Maine from January through May, which is kind of the hard some of the hard months.
I take it you're not a snow lover
in Maine. I do love winter, but 25 Maine winters is plenty. Your question actually makes me. You asked me how do I think of it as a trans person, and in some ways I think it raises a really interesting question, which may not have been where you were going, but. I, to some degree, and I know this is a little embarrassing for me to ask as the honoree of this year's Fantasia Fair, but here's a question to consider. Am I still transgender? Am I a transgender person at all?
That's always a good question.
Well,
right?
Depending on, again, this is, I think, a good example of the breadth of our community. Some folks that you ask that question to would say, well, sure, you're trans, duh.
Yeah.
And other people would take a very, people who take a medicalized view of gender, but especially them. Some people would say, well, I'm transgender in the same way that a person who's in, who's a cancer survivor has cancer. I mean, do you have cancer if you're in remission?
Right.
I mean,
good analogy. Yeah.
I mean, I don't really see gender that way. I don't see trans identity. But so when you say as a trans person, I'll be honest. When I'm not at Fantasia Fair, I don't spend a lot of time thinking of myself as a transgender person. By which I mean, the leading edge of my identity is that as a woman, as a wife and as a mother, as a teacher, as a writer, and the fact that I, what's the phrase we use now? I'm a person of transgender history. It's certainly part of my identity, and it's the thing I write about a lot because it's so interesting and it's full. There's so many cool and necessary and important stories to be told about that experience. But at the same time, you know, if I'm walking around New York City, I don't particularly have... I mean, I've had experiences... I can tell you my experience as a woman in New York City, which is sometimes quite freaky, and sometimes it. There are, you know, the classic construction worker who says things as you walk by, or teaching at Barnard, which is an all-women's college. So it's in an all-female environment. There are times... I tell you, the most gendered aspect of my experience in New York City as a woman is probably riding the subway at night or walking down a street by myself, which is gives me a kind of vulnerability and fear that I did not have in the first two-thirds of my life. Mm-hmm. And so as a woman, I feel at risk and vulnerable and on display culturally. And I feel that I'm viewed in a certain way in New York, that I'm in a way that I'm not in Maine or even in Provincetown. But the reason for that is also because of passing privilege, which, you know, I wouldn't say I pass all the time and that I pass without, especially also as a person who is a public person and well-known,
you know.
I mean, I was a show. It's not like my trans identity is a state secret, but, the privilege of passing means that I don't suffer the slings and arrows of the things that a lot of the folks here at Fantasia Fair experience, where, you know, people get read, people can see that you're trans, and they feel that it is their job to comment on people's appearance and to hurt people verbally, sometimes physically. So I'm immune from that as a trans person in New York, mm-hmm. but I'm not immune from what women of my age. Although I'll also say, as a woman just shy of 60 now, my experience walking around New York is a lot different from a woman in my late 30s who looked a lot younger and who dressed a lot flashier than I do now. Yep. I mean, now people seem to, what's funny to me now, if people don't know me, if I meet a stranger, they usually don't know that I used to be a boy, but they can often guess that I'm an English teacher.
That's interesting.
People guess, I mean, just from either from the way I talk or just from the way I look, people either guess English teacher or minister. Which I think, wow. I guess, is that what we all yearn for when we are trying to perfect our perfect Kardashian makeup? I hope people think I'm a minister.
Right.
And if not a minister, at least maybe an English professor.
Right.
That's, I don't know. Anyway.
Okay, so let's shift now to your writing. You've been a writer for a number of years. What made you decide to write your first book?
My very first book? Well, my very first book was a collection of short stories called in 1988, which was really a 100% authentic juvenilia. It was the short stories I'd written in grad school, a few things I'd published in my 20s. I published three novels in my 30s, all in... all under my former byline, which was James, which I don't shy away from that. And those novels are novels of great weirdness and joy and goofiness. The Planets and the Constellations were a pair of novels I published in the early 90s, and then in the late, I think like 97, I published a novel about getting into college, a group of a dysfunctional family touring the colleges of New England, doing the, you know, the college tour. That novel was called Getting In. But when you say my first book, I think you probably mean She's Not There, which is the right. memoir that was a bestseller and kind of, I was not exactly an obscure writer in the 90s, but She's Not There took me to a whole different place. And I wrote that book kind of during transition. Some of it had been written years before because those stories had been around for years, and I could never tell the stories because it would mean outing myself in a way. So I had like the first third of that book kind of lying around for years, and I wrote the rest of it as I went through transition and as I finished transition. And I had no idea whether anyone would read it. I wrote She's Not There in a summer house that had been closed for the winter. And so I wrote it in a place of extreme isolation. I remember looking out the window at the surface of a frozen lake, and I just remember feeling so kind of cut off from the world, and I just had no idea if anyone would ever read the book. And in fact, I think the book took its publisher by surprise as well. It was an unexpected hit, and not only that, but it has also unexpectedly stayed in print, which in this publishing world is kind of a miracle. That book has stayed in print now for 13 or 14 years. And in fact, I should say that to folks who read She's Not There many years ago, people should know that there is a new updated 10th anniversary edition that came out in 2013 that includes a new introduction by me, a new kind of 10-year update chapter, and, as many people requested, a new final chapter by my wife, who's called Grace in the book, but whose real name is Dee Dee. And that update chapter is also available on medium.com. If you go to medium.com and search for Jennifer Boylan, we posted Dee Dee's afterword chapter on Medium, because so many couples going through transition, and wives in particular, wanted to know what's the deal? How are we going to make it? How did you make it? So we made Dee Dee's chapter is available for free online, and then people who want to hear that story can read it.
So if somebody did want to buy at this point your first book, they need to be sure that they get the revised
edition. I don't think the original version is for sale anymore, but there are, like, if you buy a used copy, or if you take it out of the library, you might get the 2003 edition. But you can buy it lots of different places. You can go to amazon.com, you can go to your favorite local independent bookstore. And She's Not There is now, I think, the only version that they sell is the updated version.
Good. Okay. Writing. How did you get involved in writing for the New York Times? How did that all come to be?
Well, gee. In 2008, I published a memoir. The second of my three memoirs was called I'm Looking Through You, which is a book. It's my favorite of my three memoirs, and it's the one that kind of gets around the least. I think it's kind of the middle child of those books. I'm Looking Through You was the hardest book that I wrote. It's dark. It's on the surface of it, it's a memoir about growing up in a haunted house, which I supposedly did.
Okay.
And so it's a book about ghosts, but it's also a book about haunting. And I think it uses the metaphor of haunting as a way of talking about the way... Well, as a way of talking about a couple things. One, the way we occupy our bodies as spirits inhabiting a house, which is a body. It's also a way of talking about the way we can be haunted by the people we have been, the way we can be haunted by the people we hope to become. So if you're me, let's say, or if you're a transgender person who had a past as, and if you've gone, I mean, many people don't go through full transition. I did. And so there's this before and after in my life. And if I think about the before, it can be very traumatic and complicated to try to think about the connection between the person you were. In other words, what does it mean to be a woman who had a boyhood? I know people who just cut themselves off from their earlier life and pretend that their life began. You know, they celebrate the birthday of their surgery. Like, this is my birthday. I'm 9 years old. And I want to say, honey, you're not 9 years old. You're 58, you know. Right. And this is not an anniversary of the day you became yourself. This is an anniversary of some plastic surgery, which thank God for the plastic surgery, but, you know, the person that you were is still in you. As E.T. mm-hmm. said, you know, he's right in here.
Right.
So I wrote that book. I should say the other aspect of haunting. I hope this isn't too boring. The other aspect of haunting, if you're a trans person and you've not been through transition, and you can't go through transition, or you're scared of the idea of what will happen if you do go through transition, then you can be haunted by the sense of an alternate self whom you've never quite become, or a sense of, you know, and if you're a cross-dresser, maybe you're haunted by, if you only get to cross-dress a few times a year or a few hours a week, there can be this division between mm-hmm. the two selves. Right. So that's what I'm talking about in haunting. So all of that is by way of answering your question about the Times. The New York Times, the editors at the editorial page, in fact, I guess got wind of the fact that this book, I'm Looking Through You, was coming out. It was published in, I think, January of 2008, and they wanted to know if I would write something for Halloween for the page of 2007. So yeah, I said the hell yes. It was really like a call out of the blue. So I wrote that piece, which was kind of super hits of the book in 1,000 words. And the piece, you know, it did very well, and it came together well. And a few months later, I was actually having lunch at a place in New York, and I was out with an editor who wanted me to write something, not from the Times, but we had a couple drinks at lunch, and I was, and this was, you know, this is like in the West 40s. So after lunch, I was leaving the restaurant, and I saw the Times building there on 41st and 8th Avenue. And I thought to myself, oh, the Times. I should go visit the editor of that piece, you know, the guy that I worked with. So I just kind of walked over there, and I was talking to the guard in the lobby, and the guard was got the editor on the phone. And yeah, and his part of the conversation was, yes, sir, Jennifer Boylan. No, she's here. Yes, in the lobby. No, here. She's here. And, you know, and on the other end.
Right. No.
So finally the guard just put the phone down and he said, he's coming down. So this editor came down. He said, oh, Jennifer. And I said, I was just walking through. Thought I'd say hi. He said, well, come on up. So I went up to the editorial floor of the Times and I had some coffee. And very quickly he said, okay, so what are you working on? And what I realized was that any other writer in the world would have chosen this moment and had a half a dozen articles to pitch at the guy, you know, to expand their platform and to take on their career. And I'd had a couple glasses of Sauvignon Blanc and thought I'd say hi to the guy. And I realized, thinking quickly, man, I really better come up with something fast. So I gave him a half a dozen pretty bad ideas for things that had to do with the upcoming 2008 election. And then I left there, and I remember thinking, oh God, I just made a complete fool out of myself. What was I thinking? I just assumed everybody loves me and wants to spend their time with me. Anyway, a couple months went by, and the phone rang. It was this editor who I'd kind of forgotten about, and he said, yeah, one of our columnists for Tomorrow just canceled out. Their column isn't working. Do you remember that thing you were talking about? You mentioned one of the ideas that I'd pitched at him in my panic. And he said, that was a great idea. Can you write that? And I said, okay. And he said, and we need it by tomorrow, say 12 noon. And I said, okay. And
wow.
And it was a piece that needed some kind of significant reporting to be done before I could write it. So I got up the next morning. I went out. I did the reporting. I came home. I punched it out. I mailed it in, I emailed it in, and next thing you knew, I was on the page. And they started using me as a pretty regular columnist after that. So
So here's the moral of the story. If you want to be a famous writer, boys and girls, always assume that everyone loves you and walk into the New York Times a little drunk. It'll go just like clockwork.
I have a feeling you're an exception to the rule on that one.
You think? Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm the exception to a lot of rules. It just amazes me, the good fortune. And I think about the odds have been defied by me, and I hope people know that I'm aware of that every second, and that I think when I talk, I think I sound like a fairly joyful, happy-go-lucky person, and I am, but I'm also tremendously aware of how hard things are for people, and I guess I should say that things have not always been particularly easy for me either, and though I have high spirits, I also, you know, I carry the same, you know, suitcase of trouble that that most of us carry around, and I'm aware of that.
You're listening to Out and About here on WNHH. I'm Melissa Lukes. My guest today is author Jennifer Boylan, and we're discussing her work as a writer, and we're going to shift now a little bit to talk about her work in the media. And you've been involved with both Transparent, and you were on the reality show I Am Kate. I'll start off by just asking, how did you find the experience being on I Am Kate? And of course, right now, everyone, as soon as you say the word transgender, Caitlyn Jenner kind of comes to the general public mind.
I'm wondering if we've reached and passed peak Jenner, if that now the stage is now set for the next. Super celebrity to come out. And I kept saying this to people who were frustrated by Caitlyn's politics, who were frustrated by the many ways in which she people think she fell short as a public figure on the transgender front. I keep saying there will be people who are more famous than Caitlyn Jenner who will come out I don't know of someone.
Right.
I'm not like, you know, it's not like, you know, Ted Cruz is about to come out.
Right. Okay.
Although if he did, you know, I'm sure she would be lovely and
right,
we would all support her.
Right.
But,
sure.
You know, now that with visibility comes acceptance, and with, you know, every story that's out there, it gets a little bit easier for people. And it's still unbelievably hard, and the violence and the prejudice and the terrible struggle that our people go through is just it just crushes me sometimes to even think about it. But we have made progress, and so there will be more people after Caitlyn. And so what was the experience like? It was weird, man. I mean, I guess in some ways, it was such a mixed bag of experience of emotions. Above all, like in a word, it was fun. It was fun, and I felt we were really doing good work. And I think a lot of people turned off the show when they just could not take Caitlyn's. When people found out that she was a very serious conservative, I think that a lot of people just kind of rolled their eyes and thought, well, enough with you, Caitlyn Jenner. But in fact, especially the second season of that show, you saw transgender women having a conversation among themselves that you have never heard on network television or on television before. And it was a pretty diverse group of people. We were of different races, we were of different ages, we were different kinds of transgender history. The conversations between my friend Kate Bornstein and myself, between my friend Candace Kane and me, you know, we represent a pretty wide range of experiences and, you know, in trans experience. So I loved that, and I think it helped make people understand our issues. I think it helped people understand our community. I would say I don't think I'm a natural on television. Although, I don't know, some people seem to think I played a necessary role. They had me often, I found myself in the role of scold. Like, I was the person who was in charge of bringing Caitlin down to earth or raising issues. And, you know, I had a joke. I mean, so Candace Kane was like the, you know, the glamour puss. And I said, well, you know, if we do get to do a third season, next time I want to be the beauty queen, okay? Yeah, sure. You can be the English professor. So it was... there were times it was very frustrating. There were times I felt very isolated because I felt like... sometimes I felt like I was the stick in the mud in that show. But mostly it was really fun, and I think it really did good work in the world.
Do you feel that the staff, the producers, Hollywood executives, the executives of the E! Network were totally on board and accepting?
Yeah, they were. They totally were. And that's, in some ways, that it was really moving to me because, you know, I don't have any particular love of, you know, corporate Schweinhunds. But all of the execs at E!, including their vice president in charge of programming, Jeff Old, were spectacular. They really wanted to do it right, and I think it was a great show. I'm sorry it's not going to be around for a third and a fourth and a fifth season, but I think during its short time, I think it changed the world in a good way. And you know, I can walk. I mean, I was in Paris last year. I was walking down the Champs-Élysées, and someone stopped me and said, I saw you on the French television. It's most amusing. I mean, it's funny because I was on that show because I'm a writer, and somewhere in the back of my mind, I think I hoped that it would bring my writing to a larger audience. And the ironic thing is, I think now there are a lot of people who know me from that show, but who have no idea I've ever written anything. So what are you going to do?
I know. How about Transparent? How did that, you were not on, but you were a consultant.
My influence on Transparent was very, very minor, I think. I sat down, I talked to Jill Soloway early on before they started writing the show. I spent about a week or so maybe talking with the writers in the writer's room before they started writing the show. They didn't have any trans writers on staff early on, which was a problem. And that they embarked upon a crash course of trans politics and trans sensibility. They also, to Jill Soloway's credit, embarked on a crash course of hiring transgender people to help make the show. So in some ways, the most important thing about Transparent is that it's the most trans-inclusive show that's ever been made. There's a transgender person in every department on that show, from makeup to you know, the electricians to the camera people to, I mean, there's a trans person.
Interesting.
And you know, they've cast many, many trans people on the show, some of whom play trans characters, some of whom play cisgender characters. So it's incredibly positive. Another thing I like about Transparent is that it's representative of one particularly unique trans person's identity, an older Jewish woman in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. It doesn't attempt to be the emblematic trans experience, you know. It's a very strange, weird, quirky show. The main thing that I like about that show is I think it just succeeds tremendously as art. The writing is great, the stories are great, the acting is moving. And this is just me. I like the idea of it. I mean, it's really a drama. There's a joke that it was assigned a comedy at birth, but it identifies as a
drama. Yeah, that's true.
But I like the idea of a drama that's like 25 minutes long. You travel a long way with that show in 25 minutes.
Yes.
And so anyway, all I did was talk to Jill and the writers at the beginning of season one, I tried, I think I did some stuff. I went to a couple press events, and I worked with Jeffrey Tambor early on to help him, I don't know how much of me is in that character. There's one thing I do, which is I kind of feel the side of my cheek with my finger sometime like this, or I nervously play with my forefingers run through my hair. So I think Jeffrey got that from me. We had a wonderful lunch at the Algonquin one day, and I know he was just looking at me thinking, what of her can I steal? Anyway, Jeffrey's been really, really nice to me. He thanked me in most of his speeches when I give him an award.
Well, at the Emmys this year, yeah.
The Emmys, yeah. So that's all sweet. Great show.
Good. Glad to hear it. Okay, we're getting a little short on time, so we're going to totally shift gear now, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about GLAAD. Tell us a little bit about that organization and what they do and what your involvement is with them.
GLAAD is, well, there are a number of LGBTQ advocacy nonprofits in this country, and they each do different work, and they do work in different spaces. So my friend Mark Kiesling, who introduced me actually at the event last night, is the head of the NCTE, that's the National Center for Transgender Equality. So that's a group, for instance, that is focused specifically on legislation and laws and the political scene as regarding trans people. We have HRC, which is the Human Rights Campaign, also doing the same work in DC for a larger LGBTQ audience. What is GLAAD? GLAAD is not a political organization. GLAAD does not do any legislation work. We don't do law work primarily. GLAAD tells stories. GLAAD uses the media to accelerate acceptance for our people. So we work with writers and producers in Hollywood to make sure that scripts are done accurately, that LGBTQ people are presented with dignity. When people get it wrong, we call them out. So GLAAD is one of a number of organizations that is helping to, I hope, improve the world for our people. And GLAAD's particular mission is just through television, movies, print, blogs, any place stories are told. And that's why I'm involved with it, because I'm really not a politician particularly. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know policy. But I'm not bad at telling a story once in a while.
That's for sure. What is your assessment of the average American, if there's such a thing, and their attitude towards transgender? It seems transgender people. I seem to feel that people, we get a lot of negativity in the news about North Carolina and the discriminatory law that's been passed down there. But on the other hand, it seems like people are really, over the last 10 or 15 years, coming around and becoming much more accepting of transgender people. Is that your opinion too?
Things have certainly changed over the last 10 or 15 years, and particularly the last 5 years. Things have changed incredibly swiftly. And I think part of that is because our stories are being told in a better way. They're being told in a more public way. I'm really proud of She's Not There. It was the first best-selling book to tell our stories from our point of view. There have been a couple great books since then. Most notably, Janet Mock's book, I think, was wonderful. There have been some good shows as well. Transparent and I Am Kate and I Am Jazz being three. So, who is this average American? I don't know. I don't think I've ever met an average American. Things have gotten better. We know that. But they've not gotten better for everyone, and they've not gotten better everywhere. So, if you're a white person with passing privilege living in a blue state, things are probably a whole lot better than they were. If you're a person of color, or if you're a person in a red state, or if you're a person who doesn't pass particularly well, or some combination of all of those, things may not be better, and in some ways they may be worse. Because now, it used to be that I think trans people just kind of flew under the radar, and people didn't even know we existed. Now I think people, a lot of false fear has been stirred up. And so now people are afraid of something they didn't even used to know existed. So violence is up, especially against people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's it's a mixed bag. I on the whole, things are better, but they're not better everywhere, and they're not better for everybody.
Well, progress is, well, I think we're heading in the right direction, that's for sure.
I certainly hope so.
Okay, GLAAD, if people want more information about GLAAD, what's the website for that?
G-L-A-A, that's two A's, GLAAD.org, GLAAD.org will take you where you need to go. And if you want more information about me, jenniferboylan.net, J-E-N-N-I-F-E-R-B-O-Y-L-A-N, jenniferboylan.net. And you can learn more about my YA book, Falcon Quinn and the Bullies of Greenblood, which all the profits go to anti-bullying work. And it's a delightful story about monsters and humans and what it's like to be different. And stay tuned for my new novel, Long Black Veil, which is coming out from Penguin Random House this spring, which I hope will be everywhere.
Good. Well, I look forward to having you back on the show. We'll talk more about those books at another time. But I want to thank you today for taking the time to talk to me. I've been speaking with Jennifer Boylan. I think we can say award-winning author.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for taking the time. I appreciate you doing it.
A pleasure. Good luck.
And this is Melissa Lukes. Thanks for listening to Out and About here on WNHH. If you have any questions for me or actually for Jennifer, you can send them to me and I'll get them to her. My email address is WNHHMelissa, all one word, @yahoo.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.